It's a really lucky thing that nobody got hurt in a Washington, D.C. incident in December when a man fired a rifle in a pizza place. The story from police, the shooter went there because it was supposed to be the location of a child sex ring run by Hillary Clinton. That's the way it was reported by some alt-right fake news sites and spread across social media. There was no sex ring in the basement. There was not even a basement. Why do people believe outlandish things? That's one of the things explored by a couple of cognitive scientists who wrote a book on how well brains work solo and in teams. Dr. Stephen Sloman is professor at Brown University and the editor of the journal Cognition. Dr. Philip Birnbach is a professor of marketing and a cognitive scientist at the University of Colorado. Together, they wrote The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Stephen Sloman, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Philip Birnbach, thanks for you joining us as well.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
I had to laugh at one of the book blurbs, and Stephen, you can start us off here. Sloman and Birnbach are experts on ignorance.
Yes, well, it takes one to know one, right?
Right.
I guess that a large part of the inspiration for the book, perhaps I shouldn't admit this on the air, but it's, you know, observing my own thought processes and appreciating how little I know about things. So the question arises, you know, if I know so little and if other people are like me, well, they probably know so little too, and yet we achieve so much. So how is that possible? How is it possible that humanity, you know, can build laptop computers and iPhones and get to the moon despite the fact that people are sort of ignorant?
Well, and Philip, does ignorance come from believing that we as individuals are smart people?
So one of the major ideas of the book, the reason it's called The Knowledge Illusion, is because we tend to dramatically overestimate how well we ourselves understand things. A lot of that has to do with the fact that what we are really good at is drawing information and knowledge from wherever it exists, even if it's not in our own heads. So human beings are great at collaborating and sharing knowledge across their networks, and that leads us oftentimes to feel like the knowledge is actually between our own ears when it's not.
So, Philip, in some ways, I mean, are we doing what comes natural to us by using Google now to search for things if we don't know the answer right away?
Yeah, absolutely, and that's really feeding into this aspect of human cognition. There's actually quite some interesting research showing that when people search Google for facts, for instance, then they subsequently feel like they understand things better, and they're more likely they feel like they're going to do better on subsequent tests, even if they don't have Google. So this availability of knowledge through the web is really an outgrowth of this very natural human tendency to share information.
But it sounds like we quickly adopt what we read as, well, I read this thing, and then it becomes, well, I know this thing.
Yeah, so there's some great work done by a psychologist named Dan Gilbert quite a number of years ago, in which he compared what he called the Cartesian view of knowledge to the Spinozan view of knowledge. Those are just fancy words to describe the fact that the philosopher Descartes said that when you encounter new information, so if somebody tells you something, for instance, Descartes said, well, you first evaluate it, and if you think it's true, then you incorporate it into your knowledge base, and if you think it's false, you don't. Spinoza said something quite different. He said that when you encounter something, when someone tells you something, then you automatically encode it in your database of knowledge. And you might sometimes go back and check, and you might throw out pieces of information. But that's not something you do automatically. What you do automatically is believe what you're told. Imagine if you went around the earth trying to verify everything that you encountered, right? Is that really a human being? Is that really a glass of water? Is that really a belief that I shouldn't hold? It would take an inordinate amount of time, and we wouldn't survive as individuals.
But the things that we believe that we can't see, you know, things like religion, things like my political party is good and the only good political party. I mean, did we grow up in cultures where we're essentially marinated in these beliefs?
Exactly. Yeah, so that's the fundamental topic of the book, that our beliefs, that you should think about people mostly as channeling the beliefs of the community that surrounds them. So the most important determinant of what we're going to believe is which community we join, as opposed to, you know, what our rational thought processes lead us to believe.
Stephen Sloman and Philip Birnbach are guests on the Jefferson Exchange, the authors of The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. Join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Stephen, Eugene is calling in. Welcome to the Exchange.
Howdy. Yeah, you kind of stole my thunder. I was going to say there is the root of the problem here seems to be that people confuse belief with reality, and there is a difference. And I'm still trying to grapple with reality. I'm 72 years old. I'm not sure at all that I have a good grasp on it, but, you know, could you sort of examine what the difference is between these two things and what the harm can come from confusing them?
All right, belief and reality. Thanks for that, Steve. Appreciate it. Steve, you want to take that?
Sure. So, you know, I do think that that's a key problem. And in fact, there's some evidence that the older we get, the more we are aware of how little we know. The more we're aware that so much of what we thought was knowledge is really just belief that may not be grounded in reality. We appreciate the complexity of the world.
Let me cast this a different way. Philip Birnbach, since you're a professor of marketing, among other things, I mean, you're in the business of trying to change people's minds, or at least confirm a belief in a product anyway. So, I mean, how easy or difficult is it to change minds of people when you present them with new evidence?
If people are tied into a belief, so one aspect that's related to the issues we were talking about before is that most of the beliefs that we have are not sort of isolated pieces of information that we can just throw away if somebody tells us they're wrong. But they're tied up with so much. This is true in marketing as well, that when we buy a product, it's really a signal of our identity and so on. The beliefs that we maintain tend to be wrapped up with other beliefs, wrapped up with our identity, and so on. And therefore, it's not so simple to just say, hey, you're wrong about this particular thing. You should discard that belief. So changing minds is certainly difficult.
All right. Go ahead, Stephen.
Sorry, can I just elaborate for a moment on that? I do think it's important to distinguish things we know directly from observation, from things we know through inference, right? So if we do come across a new product, we may know it's red, and that's not a matter of social consensus or anything. That's just something we know directly. But there's relatively little that is like that. Most of the important information we have to infer. So we may know the product is red, but we don't know how good it is. You know, if it's food, we don't know how good it's going to taste. We don't know how well any other product will work. You know, if you buy our book, you're not going to know how good it is until you've actually read it. You have to make an inference from what you hear around you. So it's very important to distinguish those two, you know, simple facts from the inferences we make. But what's really important is to appreciate how much of our knowledge is based on inference and not direct observation. And that's the stuff that your caller, I think, was getting at. That it's hard to distinguish those kinds of beliefs from reality.
Well, and it puts us in an interesting position because, as you point out, we can't all travel around the world. We can't meet people from all sorts of different cultures. We can't hang around with people from both political parties. But the point being that we do have to take people's words for a lot of things. But so that in some ways confirms incorrect beliefs at the same time. So how do we figure out how to take the good from working with in tandem with other brains and then be able to push some of it aside and look for other ways to get information into ours?
Well, that's the $1 million question, and I wish, you know, we had the final answer to that. I think to a large degree the question is, how do we identify true expertise, right? And when we're talking about, you know, the quality of food or how a toilet works, which is something we discuss in some detail in the book, we can agree on who the experts are, right? The plumber that isn't trying to rip you off is probably an expert on toilets. In the political domain, it's much, much harder. You know, we are proponents of science. We are scientists ourselves, and we believe that you can believe scientists. But that itself is a matter of dispute today, and I don't know how to resolve that problem.
Well, so it would seem, though, that part of the reason that so many people do believe that climate change is happening is because we have scientists declaring 97% of them by most counts. And I don't know, after a while, you get to doubt, you know, where the original number came from. But anyway, 97% listed on the NASA site, the NOAA site, whatever, of scientists think there is a human connection to climate change. So that makes it easier, it seems like, for a lot of the population to accept that. Because they are scientists.
That's right, yeah. I mean, the challenge is that if you're on different side of the issue, you draw on different sources of expertise to tell you what's the valid sources of information. So people who are relying on the scientific consensus and looking to that take that for granted. Now, those people don't necessarily know anything more about the mechanics of global warming than people on the other side of the debate. They just happen to be drawing on sources of expertise that are correct in that case. And so the dynamics of how these opinions form, I don't think are too different across the two sides. But it's the sources that we draw on.
So flip it around. When so many scientists do believe that there's a human cause to climate change, why do some people insist it is not true? Where do they get the view and the expertise that they're relying upon?
That comes from their community. So there's experts or, you know, purported experts in their community, people that they trust who are telling them very different things. One thing, so there's been research actually trying to understand where, say, for instance, opposition to scientific consensus on climate change comes from. And one thing that's been found in that research is that people tend to overestimate how well they actually understand the climate science. And so if you ask people to try to explain how this stuff works, they very similar to the other research that we've talked about today, they find that they don't really have much to say. And in fact, that might be the only way that you can soften people and open their minds a little bit, is by getting them to realize that actually it's not as simple as they had thought. And if you teach them a little bit about the mechanics of how it works, then that actually gets them to be a little bit more open.
So probe their knowledge a bit.
Yeah, probe their knowledge and then give them some information that comes in the form of, this is how global warming works, as opposed to something of the form, this is the scientific consensus, this is what the experts are saying, why don't you accept that, what's wrong with you? So it might be more effective in terms of fostering open-mindedness to get people to confront their ignorance as opposed to telling them that they're wrong.
Philip Birnbach and Stephen Sloman are cognitive scientists. Philip at the University of Colorado, Stephen at Brown University, and they are talking about their book, The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. You can join the conversation on The Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when we turn to political realms, like, say, liking Obamacare, whether it's referred to as Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, is it often enough just to check the people around you and be satisfied that they feel the way you do? Is that the way we tend to do it, Stephen Sloman?
Absolutely. That's exactly what we tend to do. And no, that's not sufficient, because the people around you may be just as ignorant as you are. Let me quickly tell you about a little experiment I ran with a student at Brown named Nat Rabb. We told people about novel scientific phenomena. The truth is, we made the phenomena up. They aren't real. Things like systems of helium rain. So we said scientists have discovered this system of helium rain, and they haven't yet explained it. They don't fully understand it. How well do you understand it? And the right answer is, I don't understand it at all. Right? And that's just what people said. But in another condition, another group of people, we said, well, scientists have discovered the system of helium rain, and they understand it. Right? They have a complete explanation for it. How well do you understand it? And now, you know, people didn't say, oh, I fully understand it, but there was a little bump in their rating of understanding.
Huh. They felt they knew more because people in a position of expertise knew more.
Exactly. So the idea is that understanding is contagious, right? When the people around you feel they understand, then you feel you understand. Now, on many political issues, there's very little understanding, in part because the issues are so very complicated. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you think you understand because the people around you understand, and the people around you understand because the people around them understand, right? Everybody could have this sense of understanding, even though nobody actually understands. It could just be an illusory bubble of understanding or a house of cards. And I think often in the political realm, that's exactly what happens.
Stephen, is there a relationship between strength of feeling and depth of knowledge?
Often they're inverses of one another.
So the less they know, the more strongly they feel?
There was a cute experiment run by a group of scientists, and they asked people to first identify the location of the Ukraine on a map. And then they asked them how confident they were in the statement that the U.S. should invade Crimea, right? When Crimea is in the Ukraine. And what they found was that those people who were least accurate in identifying the location of the Ukraine on a map had the strongest feelings about the U.S. invading Ukraine.
Yeah, let me add to that. I've been running a bunch of studies on people's attitudes about divisive science-based issues like genetically modified organisms mm-hmm. and how they feel about them. And often what we do is collect a variety of different measures, and some of the measures that we collect are how extreme they are in their opposition, how well they think they understand genetic engineering, and then we also perform a science literacy kind of test where we ask people questions, objective questions about genetic engineering to assess their objective knowledge. And we find very interesting patterns. And it's often the case that people who are the most extreme feel like they understand it the best, but actually understand it the least. So you get quite perverse kind of results like that.
So that's believing that they know best what's in their own heads. But what happens then, Philip, in fake news? Why do people elevate the likes of Rush Limbaugh or Alex Jones when they may be aware of the fact that the New York Times and NPR are telling a very different story?
Well, we all choose the communities that we affiliate with, and we trust the experts in our community because they reflect our core values and our worldviews. And like we were talking about before, with all these, with this idea that all of our beliefs are sort of wrapped up together to constitute our identity and our community, we are going to draw on, and we're at least going to not scrutinize as strongly the beliefs that are conducive and consistent with those worldviews.
I wonder if it, maybe I'm pushing this point too hard, but if it gives pause to anyone when they fall upon an organization giving information that says, I got this story better than they got it. I mean, maybe just as a skeptic, that makes me suspicious right from the get-go. But does that cause anybody else any trepidation, or is it just more or less like you like the way they sound, they're saying what you believe, and therefore you stay there?
Well, I think that that's often exactly what happens. You like the way it sounds, meaning it resonates with your belief system because this is what your community has told you to believe, and therefore you accept it and you don't check it. When you come across a piece of information that contradicts what you believe, that's when you check it, right? That's when you think that this may be something that's false. So I actually think a large part of the answer to the fake news problem is to try to develop a norm in our communities that says, check things before you believe them. I had this experience recently on Facebook. I read something that was consistent with my beliefs, and I just took it for granted. And then there was, I think, a philosopher who commented on it saying, this is BS. This isn't true. And I realized it probably wasn't true. It didn't change my outlook on life because I'm a human being like everyone else. But I did at least become aware that that particular piece of information was not something that I should pass on.
So what do we do to educate ourselves or otherwise peer above the rim of our own cup of understanding?
Yeah, that's a great question. The answer is not to learn everything about every topic. It's just not possible. So we're not advocating in the book that everybody should become experts before taking a position on any issue. But what I think we should do is try to more frequently, as Steve was just saying, ask ourselves, do we really understand this? It's perfectly fine to have an attitude that's based on, you know, trusting the expertise in your community. It's absolutely necessary. But I think it's probably not okay to have a really extreme opinion about something that you don't understand very well. So engaging in that process of checking yourself every once in a while, do I really understand this, will induce some level of intellectual humility, which I think is pretty healthy for society. It makes it much easier to talk to people from the opposing side.
So did you guys write a better book working together?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we were definitely complementary, I think, in what we brought to the book.
Well, obviously the minds work better together. Did Paul and John then write better Beatles songs working together?
Not only did they write better Beatles songs, they wrote Beatles songs.
Oh, there
wouldn't
true.
Have been Beatles songs without both of them. And in fact, you know what? You got to give George and Ringo some credit, too.
Because they provided the community in which all that took place.
Yep.
Yeah, all right. Interesting stuff in the book. It's called The Knowledge Illusion, Why We Never Think Alone. There's also a good piece by the same writers, Stephen Sloman and Philip Birnbach, in the New York Times from a couple of weeks ago. All kinds of things to think about in how we think, in singly and in pairs and in larger groups as well. Steve Sloman and Philip Birnbach, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much. Jeff. It was a great pleasure.
Good to have you.